Item 26, what possible discussion on legislative review, Matt Phillips.
Okay, I'll be brief. There's a report in your book. Any questions? Am I going to get off that easy? Am I going to work like that? Okay. Earlier, Jim Forte mentioned that I might talk about in-stream flows in Senate Bill 3. Because of the length of that particular bill, I'm going to touch on it very briefly. Senate Bill 3, the main thing that we are going to be involved in is the environmental flows process. Although it was a very large bill, involved a lot of different things, that's probably the major issue. We're going to be involved in that at the regional level. The environmental flows portion will be similar to the regional water planning effort, where at the local level, they will develop environmental flow standards and set-asides to then be sent up to the state, to TCEQ, to be adopted in rule. Those set-asides will be used to permit or to do water permits. We'll be involved as a member of a regional stakeholder group. So that's kind of how we'll be involved in Senate Bill 3.
And they started talking about the study, the Brazosville, was that that?
No, we're there.
We're there because of the system-wide permit.
We're actually pushed off. We're not until 2009. The Brazos River Basin doesn't have to be set up for the environmental flows process until 2009. They prioritize the basins. We're later.
Because they think we don't have a bigger issue.
Right, and I can't say exactly why they prioritized them in the way that they did. I don't know the method to their madness. I think they just tried to split it up as best as they could, because to do them all at once would be just too much of an undertaking, so they kind of tried to phase it in. So we'll be starting that process around 2009. So I will spare you some of the details on Senate Bill 3. Like I said, in your book, there's a pretty lengthy report that goes into the details on that. What I want to talk about is some of the local government stuff that passed, stuff that we're going to have to comply with on a day-to-day basis. One of the first bills I'll mention is House Bill 590. Has to do with adopting ethics policies. It requires public entities, state agencies, to adopt ethics policies. The policy will be developed by the Attorney General's office. You can use that one as a model. Obviously, you can, you know, change it depending on how you want to do that. But so that is something that we will be looking at in the near future, as far as bringing that to you and adopting an ethics policy. The second piece of legislation that you all will be very familiar with is the conflicts disclosure bill. There was a piece of legislation this session to clean up that obviously extremely onerous law from last session. While some would say it may not have cleaned it up enough, I think it actually went pretty far, and Riley probably knows more of the details than I do. But what it tried to do was define some of the terms that were previously left open and undefined. One of the things it defines is contract, where instead of just being an open word contract, it has to be a written contract. It also defines a business relationship to mean a connection between two or more parties based on a commercial activity of one of the parties. It also goes in, I know some of y'all were interested in this, investment income. It defines investment income, which is exempt from the need to disclose a conflict. Investment income means a personal or business checking, savings, share draft account. So that will be exempt from the need to disclose. I know that was a big one for some of the folks. And one of the other things it does is it exempts gifts from family members for the need for disclosure. I know that there was a question about if I've got a son or daughter that works for Dell, I believe was the question, and they give me a computer. You won't have to worry about that anymore, because it's actually covered now. They cleaned some of the stuff up. So all in all, it should be a more manageable law. It should be easier to comply with. And like I said, they cleaned that up pretty well this session. Next thing I'll talk about is Senate Bill 657. Has to do with contracting, bidding, and purchasing. The purpose of that bill was to raise the thresholds for competitive bidding. The thresholds as they exist in statute right now were developed about 15 years ago, so they're kind of old and extremely low when compared to today's standards. So it raises them from 15,000 and 25,000 respectively to 25,000 and 50,000. So with regard to bidding, it makes it to where you don't have to go out for bid on some of the very low cost things that you would have previously. I'll move on to talk a little bit about contracts with regard to attorney's fees. One piece of legislation that passed was you have to have reciprocal attorney fee agreements in contracts from now on. If you have a contract that allows for the awarding of attorney's fees, it cannot only allow them for one party. Both parties have to be able to receive attorney's fees if there's a dispute under the contract. So any contracts that we have henceforth will have to comply with that. One of the more interesting pieces of legislation that passed has to do with construction and project delivery, and that's House Bill 1886. It's the design build bill. John Hoffman and John Baker went to a seminar in San Antonio to learn a little bit more about that. But essentially what the bill does is, back in 97, the legislature allowed school districts to begin using design build as a form of project delivery. And then in 2001, they also expanded it to other entities. Well, what they did in House Bill 1886 this session was expand it to entities like river authorities and water districts. So essentially what that'll be is another tool for project delivery for us as an entity. And because there are folks who may not have been sure about it or worried about implementing it, they kind of phased it in. You have to meet certain population requirements to be able to use it. And you also can only do a certain number of projects per year. And so, for instance, if you're an entity that has a population of 500,000 or more within your service area or geographical boundaries, you can only do 3 design-build projects per year. So that's essentially how that works. It's going to be very phased in. Next, one thing of note is our non-substantive recodification. If any of you guys are ever looking for our enabling legislation, normally you would look in Chapter 221 of the Water Code. We are no longer going to be located there. This session moved to the Special Districts and Laws Code as part of a massive non-substantive recodification. We will now be located in, and this is just going to be fun to have to find, Chapter 8503, Special Districts and Laws Code. So that's where we're going to be from now on.
You know, sometimes when things are recodified, they actually move you under something that have different rules.
They did not do that. It was completely non-substantive.
We read it all.
Okay. We checked it.
I'm just kind of paranoid about that.
Trust me, this session.
I've seen them do stuff.
This session, we were watching. Don't worry. And now, obviously, they didn't do anything that was under the table at all. Another piece of legislation relating to open meetings. Senate Bill 1306 has to do with the attendance of a quorum with regard to open meetings if there's certain events like a press or ceremonial event. And what it does is it basically says if it is a press and or ceremonial event and a quorum is going to be there, you don't have to post it. You don't have to comply with those open meetings laws as long as you're not going to contract or conduct business of any sort. So it kind of loosened that up a little bit.
What about dinner?
I think we'd have to check and see what the interpretation on that is. I think it's actually pretty specific to a press or ceremonial event. I think we'd probably still have to post dinner because it's not specifically a press or ceremonial event. Next thing has to do with open records. It was a bill, House Bill 1497 passed, it relating to the consequences of failure by a person to clarify an open records request. That's actually good for a governmental body such as ourselves who does get open records requests. Basically what that says is if we get an open records request and it's large and broad, like relating to water sales, you know, I want everything you got relating to water sales. Obviously, that'd probably take a while and it'd probably be quite a few documents. If you then send a request for clarification to that person and they do not send you back direction or clarification within 60 days, then their request is nullified and you don't have to go forth with it. So there was actually some cleanup, and that was a good piece of legislation. It's actually a huge issue, as Laura Lee says. Another piece of legislation with regard to open records I'll touch on real quick has to do with the authority of a governmental body to require payment of a charge before complying with requests to produce public information. Public entities spend massive amounts of time on public info requests, obviously. What this particular piece of legislation does is it allows a public entity to set a time over which they will begin charging fees for complying with public records requests. So, and that amount of time can't be any less than 36 hours in a given calendar year. But if you get a request from one individual for more than that, then that person's going to have to start paying for those, for you to produce those documents and for the manpower that you have to use to produce those documents. So that's also a major issue. The last thing I'll talk about relates to eminent domain. One bill that did pass, and there were there was one big eminent domain bill that did not pass, but one of the ones that did was the Landowner's Bill of Rights. And as a public entity who has the power of eminent domain, it's something that we always need to be aware of. What this particular piece of legislation will require is that any public entity using eminent domain will have to send this Landowner's Bill of Rights to any person in the affected area. The Bill of Rights will explain how the process works, what their rights are, what they can request, how you go about doing it. The Attorney General's office is going to draft and prepare that Landowner's Bill of Rights. They have to do it by, I'm not exactly sure when they have to do it, but I think it's actually by the end of this year they have to draft that policy. So that's something for us to watch for. The other piece of legislation relating to eminent domain that did pass is House Joint Resolution 30. What that has to do with is allowing landowners whose property was taken by eminent domain to be able to purchase that property back if the purpose for which it was taken does not go through. So if property was taken for a reservoir, they can purchase it back, but the particular provision is it allows them to purchase it back for the price that they were paid at the time that it was taken. So could have been 30 to 50 years ago. Now, the interesting thing about that is a constitutional amendment, which will go before the voters in November. However, it's enabling legislation. House Bill 2006, which was the big eminent domain bill this session, did not pass. So it'll be an amendment to the Constitution without any enabling legislation. Mind you, though, House Bill 2006 and the provisions therein, you'll see those again. We will see those again. And arguably, the eminent domain bill that was vetoed from our standpoint wasn't a bad piece of legislation. I don't think we had any problems with it. There were problems with it relating to transportation projects that ended up in it being vetoed. And the very last thing I'll talk about has to do with peace officer identification. It's one that I skipped over, but since we do employ peace officers, it's one of the things that we are going to have to comply with. It requires governmental entities to develop and issue identification cards to any peace officers that they employ. And those identification cards have to state the full name of the officer, a photograph, the name of the agency that employs them, so Brazos River Authority in this case, signature of the person, a brief description, height, weight, eye color, all those kind of things, a thumbprint, the date of their employment, and the date the card was issued, and in addition, a phone number, operational 24 hours, where their identity can be checked. Now, the purpose of that is to try to stop the practice of impersonating peace officers. So since we employ peace officers, that's something that we're definitely going to have to work on. Now, any of the pieces of legislation that have passed that require policy changes, we're obviously going to be working on those, and any ones that we need to bring to y'all, we will be bringing to y'all at the next meeting. So I rushed through that, but if y'all have any questions.
We don't have a 24-hour number, do we?
I believe we do.
We have farm employment of our lake rangers.
Well, we have a well. That's something we'll have to develop. Then, obviously, again, these are policy changes we're going to have to work on. So, be happy to answer any questions related.
Any questions, Matt?
Session related.